Hey, this is Jimmy DeGrasso from Blackstar Riders, and you're listening to Focus on Metal.
Hey, metalheads, Scott Thompson here, welcoming you to Focus on Metal. Holy crap, I gotta tell you that Mother Nature has been unleashing her fury around us here at the Focus on Metal studios. When Dario, who lives up in Winnipeg, emails me and says, "Holy crap, dude, you guys are getting some really shitty winter weather," then you know your winter weather is totally shitty. So I think right around the area so far, we've had about 4 feet of snow in the last 2 weeks. So fun times. But within all of that, we've only had to reschedule one interview. And otherwise, we've been able to get shows out every week. And everything just keeps right on rolling here at Focus on Metal. And that includes our show this week. And you may have guessed from the beginning of the show that our guest is once again Jimmy DeGrasso, the great drummer from Blackstar Riders. Of course, the guys play with a bunch of other people as well. Last time we had Jimmy on, we talked about a lot of that stuff. This time, Jimmy came on to talk about the brand new Blackstar Riders release, The Killer Instinct. So there's a couple of really cool things involved with this interview. So one is the fact that pretty much all the way across the board for the press for this brand new album, it's been being handled by Damon and Ricky. I think we might be the only people out there that got Jimmy to come on the show and talk about the new album. So there's very cool thing number one. And number two is that, you know, we've had Jimmy on before, and it's really nice when a guest remembers that he was on the show, and even in a lot of cases what he even talked to you about last time. So from that experience to this one, we've become, you know, pretty friendly with Jimmy, and we had just a whole crap load of stuff that we talked about before we actually even got to the interview. Just we're going on and on. I'm just joking around, having a great time, talking about, just like I said, all kinds of stuff, which culminated in this little bit of discussion.
Oh, see, always fun to have you on the show. You always have have some good laughs.
Oh, you're not using any of this shit, are you?
No, not at all, Jimmy.
You're
the
fucking best stuff we got.
No.
That should give you a little bit of a flavor of the tone going into this interview. Just having a lot of laughs. Always great when you have a guest like this. And as I said, Jimmy was having a lot of fun with this. When we went to get serious about actually getting down to the interview, Jimmy decided he was going to give us his 30-second soundbite interview about the album, as if we were just a normal radio station interviewing him.
You know what? No, let's get to the meat and potatoes. This is the best record we've ever done. I couldn't be happier. The record company's really doing a great job promoting it. Our producer's great. All right, anything else?
No, good night, Jimmy.
Fuck off.
No, I don't do that.
You know, there's kind of the indicative thing of when you got the 20-second press spots on the radio stations, and they ask you the same questions, and they expect you to give the same answers. And as I said, Jimmy was having a ton of fun. We know this was going to be a great interview going in when you're having so much fun in just the first half hour of it before you've even started the interview. So before we get into the interview, and I know from those little two teases, you're psyched about it, you want to hear what Jimmy has to say, I just got to make one quick disclaimer. And that is the fact that this album, Blackstar Riders, The Killer Instinct, does not come out until February 24th. So in order to meet all the licensing requirements for the stations that we syndicate to, you really can't play music off of unreleased albums or, you know, things before they've actually gotten released. I know you guys are going to be disappointed. Normally we have guests on, we have a lot of samples from the album, but in this case, because the album isn't out yet, and even though we've heard the album, we have a copy of the album, we really can't play anything off of it unless it's been released as a single. The good news is they did release one single off it so far, the title track, The Killer Instinct. So, yep, we can play some of that, but that is the only new track we're going to be able to play throughout this show. I know it's kind of a bummer, but that's what we have to do to stick to the letter of the law with all of our syndication agreements. However, that doesn't mean I can't play some other BSR and Thin Lizzy related songs as well. So there is music in tonight's show, just not as much as we normally have, and only the one new track off the new one, because like I said, it hasn't been released yet. And also, we had such a good talk with Jimmy that he's going to pretty much take up the whole show. We want to make sure we get it all in. So with that, we are also going to bypass track of the week this week as well. So with that, let's dive in with our chat with Jimmy DeGrasso of Blackstar Riders.
We're so psyched to have you back on. And someone had mentioned me about, you know, I was talking about, oh man, we're going to have some, get someone from BSR on. And they were saying, well, are you going to get Scott? And I joked and said, well, I hope not, because usually he has a hard time remembering everything. So I was like, we need to have somebody else with him to prompt him. And so I was really hoping to get you back on again, because one, we always have a lot of fun, and but you've always got some good talk to do as well. So.
Well, I can impersonate Scott too. No, good. Just so, go ask me a Scott question.
Oh, so do you remember when you were doing that harmony riff, and how did you compose that?
Oh man, what song was that, man? I don't even remember most of the 1970s, man. but I know it was kick ass.
That is an amazing Scott.
You know what? Sometimes it's just credit. He will remember something really clearly, and you'll be a bit surprised. Like, you'll remember a really vivid, like, event or a moment where he, like, you know, we were in this room, and this lid came up, and I broke this, and this happened. And when I read a lot of his book, and I asked him about that, and I said, for someone who can't remember a lot of things, how do you remember those things? He's like, you know, some of the stuff is real clear and some of it's not. And then, you know, then he said, when we would start to go down that road, a lot of stuff would start to come back. But if you just ask him to go back and just remember a point in time, I think that's hard for me sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, I think, you know, someone was asking me about something like 20 years ago. I'm like, man, I don't, someone asked me to play a song at a jam of a band I used to be in a long time ago. And I'm like, I have no idea.
We had a Vinny Appice on over a year ago, and whatever album we were discussing, he was like, is that track on it? No. Is that track on it? No. What about this one? No, Vinny, that's the two albums after that. He just couldn't remember
it's,
all
it's
the
It's hard. Well, you know, it's hard, man. It's like, you know, there's so much, after you do it for a long time, I mean, I remember most of it, and there was just so much of it to try to remember certain songs or certain records, and you know, it's a lot, you know. If you've done like one or two records and you've only been doing it a couple of years, everything's real clear and compact. But when you do this like 25, 30 years, it's kind of like, okay, you're going to have some gray area for sure.
Oh yeah. I still have people that ask me about like a song that I had written, and I'd be like, I'd be sitting there with a guitar going, God damn, I don't remember how to play it. And like, well, you wrote it.
Yeah.
I still don't remember it.
Yeah.
I played it for like 25 years.
You wrote it, figure it out. Like, you know, and that, hey, listen, that happens a lot with everybody. That's just not, like, I've known a lot of people that can't remember their own songs.
Yeah.
And I've been around a few of them.
Yeah, I think, Jimmy, the fans know all the songs because they listen to the records a lot, but you find, I tend to read that a lot of the musicians, once the album is done, they won't revisit it unless they're actually going to play the song on a tour.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, because what happens is, you know, if you're going to do the record, your record's 10 to 12 songs, a bonus track, whatever, and okay, I want to go out, we're going to do 3-4 songs tops off the new record. Well, you know, the other 8 or 9, you'll never even go near again.
Right.
I mean, it was literally a once and done deal. And unless you really dig deep into catalog, for alternatives for tour sets, if after you have 3, 4, 5 records out, you can't play the entire catalog.
Yeah. Have you ever played in a band, Jimmy, that's gone and done an album from back to front?
No, I don't think I've ever been in a band that did a record that anyone wanted to hear back to front.
It seems to be the end thing now that bands are playing it, you know, oh, this is 20 years old, or it's, you know, 25 years old, and we're going to go out and tour and play the whole record.
Right. No, some of that, you know, there's certain records that I think you could do that with. I mean, I think most of the records I've done, you could probably do that. I shouldn't say. I mean, there's certainly, every record I've done, there's always like one track on the record that makes me go, don't need to hear that one again, because that's a good percentage, man, because, you know, it's hard to, like, all of a sudden we're going to create 12 songs and I'm going to love all 12. You know, that's, you're being unrealistic.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I remember when I heard about this 15, 16 years ago, I remember Cheap Trick was doing their first 3 records 3 nights in a row.
Yeah.
And I thought, that was the first time I heard about it. I'm like, that's really freaking cool. You know, I would have loved to. Actually, I was trying to go to one of those shows, but I think I was on the road.
Yeah. So. I remember Scott was telling me that when Judas Priest did British Steel, all he wanted to hear was him do the song The Rage, because they'd never played it live. And when that when they started playing that, like, a lot of the fans, the diehard fans were like, yes, and all the people, like the Living After Midnight people and all that, were like, what song is this?
Yeah, exactly. But that's the way it is, especially with the internet now. And it was like, oh man, you have to play this song off that record, and you stick the same person on the internet from their grandparents' basement that's hitting that message board really hard, and it's like, I want to hear that song. But you got to realize it's you might not be it might not be as many people as you think want to hear it. So
yeah. But of course, I'm sure that, in 20 years' time, there's probably going to be a whole audience that wants to hear the Killer Instinct front to back, right?
Actually, this record, that's probably the first record I would want to, I mean, honestly, there's no dead weight on this record. And not to say the first one did have any, but I don't think there's any dead weight on this record. I think it's as simple as that. I think, it, like, which they were talking about picking singles, I'm like, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah,
I mean, because it's hard for me to pick a single with any band, but I mean, there was too many choices, and I think there's a lot of great songs on this record. But you guys have heard it.
Yeah, I've heard it. It's a little bit more varied, I think, than the first one. There's some acoustic guitar on it. Gabrielle is one track. It's a little bit more varied. When you started writing the tracks, did you do that when you were on tour for the last record, or were they all done afterwards, after the tour?
No, they were on the tour. We had, I mean, even like a year and a half ago when we were in, we were doing that European tour. I mean, there was already stuff floating around, sound checks, different licks and stuff like that. We wrote, Finest Hour was a jam we started in Cambridge in rehearsals for this summer's leg. I remember that because we were in the rehearsal place there, and we just started messing around with that. We had a lick, and then we started banging that one around. And that's how that came about. You know, there's always Ricky and Damon and Scott, who's, you know, like passing some stuff around with some ideas and messing around with them on a sound check, or they'll be in the dressing room singing in the, like, you know, tape recorders, and, like, you know what I mean? There's a constant sort of flow of creativity. It's not like we're working at it but there always seems to be an undercurrent of something new going on. So most of it was written, I think, really on the last tour with a couple of gaps in between. We squeezed it all together when we got to Nashville. We had a couple of weeks just really gluing parts together, and that's when it really sort of took serious form.
Yeah, now, did Scott get more involved in the songwriting on this one? Because I know that it was mostly Ricky and Damon did the first record.
Well, it's like, there was so many things, there's still things that haven't been worked up. So, I mean, honestly, those two guys spend the bulk of their time. Scott will bring in a few ideas here and there, and most of the work is done really by Ricky and Damon, and then Scott puts in his ideas here and there, and then he'll have, you know, idea for song in it. But, like, honestly, he doesn't quite come in with as much stuff as Ricky and Damon do.
Yeah. I think, too, this album must have been a lot more fun to do, too, right? Because, like you said, this has kind of been organic. You've been throwing stuff around, and, you know, it's not like you hit the studio and you had to come up with a bunch of stuff, that knowing what you liked or disliked, you know, going in there as well, so that you were just kind of able to make that old school album, like almost like that, you know, you're like a band's first album, because usually the first album is the one they've got years to put together, and the second one is the oh crap. And you guys, it's almost the opposite, where you've had this, I think probably because you guys are all veterans too, so you kind of like to jam around and stuff, but I think it lends itself to a different feeling album too.
Well, you got to remember too, with the first record had about a year to year and a half of preparation before it, but the first record, for all intents and purposes, was written to be a Thin Lizzy record.
Right.
And like 2 months before we go to the studio, we're like, all right, we're changing the band name. So that was kind of weird. So you really have to think this is the first record that's truly written as a Black Star Rider record, which, you know, neither one is bad. I'm just saying, you know, we had to really, either the band was called Thin Lizzy, and we had to really try to stay or please the people that were looking for the next step or progression in a Thin Lizzy record. And I think a lot of that was kind of off with this record because, you know, yeah, there's the ties to Thin Lizzy, but now this was a little bit more creatively open. Well, I like to keep the connection to those roots, but at the same time, I don't think we should limit us from a creative standpoint. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So I think that's the place we came with this record, because you hear certain things. There's on this record, there's really no reference to any Thin Lizzy sound on a few things. And it's not intentional or non-intentional. It's just, you know, the band is becoming its own creative force, and it has like sort of ties to the past. And you're going to hear that from time to time.
Yeah. Well, I think, Jimmy, it just comes out like that organically, because it doesn't sound forced. Like, oh, we have to have a song that sounds like an old Thin Lizzy song. It just comes across really well on the record. Like, I think one of the songs that I love on it is Soldier's Tongue. It's got that really Celtic feel on it, and it's got a killer riff in the middle of it. And, you know, it's obviously all about Ricky Warwick growing up in Belfast. And, I think that's a great song.
Thought he was from Cleveland. is he trying to sell that Belfast thing again?
Oh,
never mind. All right, cool.
Illusions.
Well, you know what? I'd have to say Belfast is hard. I was going to say, what's a better place?
Oh, man. But yeah.
What? You answer the question. Forget it. Just leave it go. That's the stuff we'll get in trouble for. No, but yeah, you know, and that's not forced. That's the stuff that comes out of him, and that's where he came from.
He's a great lyricist. I think a lot of people don't look at him and they think, oh, you know, he came from a band like The Almighty, and, you know, he's had some acoustic records, but he is a great lyric writer.
Fucking easy!
Yeah, he is. You know what? And I noticed that from early on because, you know, I was aware of the Almighty, but I didn't know he was that good at writing lyrics. Or, you know, knowing with him, Almighty was like, he's a really big fan of all sorts of music. You know what I mean? He's just not like rock guy or punk guy. You know, he's really into a lot of facets of music, and that's why I think his lyrics are becoming what they are, because he's just a really creative person.
And like you said, I mean, it's naturally what comes out of him, and that's what came out of Phil too. I mean, Phil was into all kinds of music as well. I think it's just kind of a cultural thing. You just can't turn it off. So, you know, it sucks when people ding him for that, like, oh, he's trying to be like Phil. It's like, no, he's just trying to be like himself, and it's just, there's a lot of common ground there. You just can't make that disappear.
Well, you know, that's funny. In being during the 70s or 80s, I remember people ding Phil for saying, oh, we're still trying to write there. Why is this album isn't enough rock? And I mean, I remember that back then. It's like everyone always gets ding for not, you know, doing the same thing over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But you know what? Well, I mean, I'm guilty of it as well. I mean, I remember when I heard, you know, certain records when the band would change direction or sort of like use different influence, I would go, oh man, this isn't heavy enough. This isn't that. This doesn't sound like the last record. But you know what? You can't keep making the same record. You can't keep writing the same song. So,
right. Yeah. And I mean, those guys would have all gotten extremely bored too. They just, it's just not something that they would have tolerated. So they wouldn't have been around as long as they were if they were trying to do the same thing album after album.
Well, yeah, that's totally right. I mean, everyone, every band, their favorite band, they want every band to go back and write their first record again. It's not like that, you know, 20 and 30 and 35 and 40 years later. And you have to understand that's impossible. You can't go back to the creative place or the personal place that you were when you were 20, 25 and be that same person again and try to put it on tape. It doesn't, absolutely, it just doesn't work. And actually, and when people try to do it, it really sounds like they're trying to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
we're going back to our roots. Oh, Rick Rubin's taking us back to our roots. Oh, great. Nice.
I can't imagine who we're talking about.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I get his whole gig. It's like, get, you know, guys that are sort of like creatively don't know where to go. And it's like, well, here, listen to your first two records. It's not rocket science. And they give them $1 million. Like, okay, I could have told you that for a lot less.
And he does it all while he's lying down too, which is just really amazing.
Which I know, which is great. I do it sitting down. He does it lying down. I think that's great. But honestly, I mean, you know, if I was producing Aerosmith, I'd go back and go listen to Toys and Rocks. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, but just because you listen to it, you can't go back and recreate it. And it's like, you know, I'm sure people used to go to Phil, hey, go back and listen to Chinatown. Well, it's like, well, I've already done that.
Yeah.
You know, this is what it is.
Yeah. So one of the other tracks, standout tracks, I think, Jimmy, in the album is Blindsided. It's a, you know, acoustic beginning, and then it rocks up a little towards the end. It's just a killer, killer song. A little bit different to what's on the first record.
Yeah, I mean, what is it, like 19 minutes long or something?
No, that's you, little liar.
Oh, dude, you know, it's funny. That song was like short. It started out. And that's like one song that comes to mind where it's like, that doesn't sound anything like you think we would put on a record. And we cut that down, and then the song was like really short. And we're like, all right, cool. And we came in with the whole keyboard thing and the breakdown and what is it, a Hammond or a BC? I'm not sure what we used on those dubs. And then we just rode the thing out with guitar solos and drum fills. And it was just kind of, we just made it up there. You know, like Nick's like, just ride that lick out for a while. I think it wound up being like 3-4 minutes. It's like, yeah. Yeah, I think he meant 30 seconds. And he meant like 5 minutes. And, but that was one of those things, like you were saying, it was just really organic and it worked out really well. And it's just, you know, that's why he's such a great producer.
Yeah. I think it's a perfect fit for you guys too, because he's one of these guys that he loves that whole, all of that, you know, any kind of music. And I think he just loves to sit back and just watch the process. He's almost as much a fan as a producer, at least he's never lost the fan side of himself, which really I think lends himself to like a band like you guys and just doing it right.
No, listen, you nailed that one. I mean, we couldn't have picked a more correct guy. I mean, he just fell into our lap. It was purely fate and luck on our part. And he is literally like the sixth Beatle. I mean, you know, we would be sitting up, or if Beatle, whatever, there's a bunch of Beatles. We would be in there, like, setting up during the day, and I would be just thinking on drums and tuning snares and stuff like that. And he'd be in the morning, and he's, like, playing Kiss records, and, like, at, like, 10, you know, there's a crank. He's like, dude, Chris, you're this night, check it out! Maybe, like, freaking, like, 115 decibels. I'm like, Nick, I haven't even had coffee yet, man. You know, and then he'd put on, like, Rush Hemispheres. Dude, check it out, Rush Hemispheres! Like, okay, we'll do it. And, you know, and we haven't even started to record yet. I've already heard three records, you know. But that's right. And then he put on Sweet, you know. And, you know, that's what he's like. He's a big fan of music. And it's, he's not corporate producer guy, you know. He's not, like, in there on the phone, like, I mean, I remember one producer I worked with. He's supposedly a big-name producer from the 70s. We were in the session for hours. I don't think he was off his phone for more than 10 seconds. And I think he finally got off his phone. He said, okay, guys, we're going to nail that track. I'm like, dude, it's been done for like 3 hours.
Yeah, but, that's definitely not Nick.
No, that's not Nick at all. So it was great to work with him. And, you know, I think the rest of the band feels the same. We were just really happy to have him. I think he took the record to a place where I don't know if we could have taken it by ourselves, which is what you have him for, you know.
Yeah. How does that process work when you pick the producer? Because you tell me if I'm wrong, Jimmy. Years ago, a lot of it was up to the record company, but now the business is completely different. Now, like the E5 guys sit down and right, I'll do this. We have this list of guys, and you say to the manager, "Look, can we get this guy, or can we get that guy, or does it just happen by not accident?" But you know what
well,
I mean?
Yeah, I totally get what you mean. In this day and age, you know, we're all fans of music, and you know, everybody knows who's out there, and there's certain guys you know you don't want to work with. I mean, I have my guys where I'm like, yeah, I've already been down that road. And then, no, it's the truth. I'm like, I mean, I know what they do. And I'm not saying in a negative sense. I've worked with a bunch of producers, and you just know what they're going to bring. You look for different producers to bring certain things. Hmm. And I wanted a producer that was certainly familiar with the band, knew what the band was about, was familiar with the lineage of the band, and understood what we were trying to do. And that doesn't mean a guy is a bad producer if he doesn't know, or he's just not into that. You just have to find the right guy to fit what you're trying to achieve. So, we listened to a couple people, we met with a couple people, and, you know, there was some, I think we could have made a good record with some of the other people we spoke to, but, you know, made some of, you know, the records I really like in the last couple of years. I mean, the Alice in Chains records he made, I thought were amazing. And, you know, and he was kind of in a weird situation with them. You know, I think it was their first record back without Lane. So, you know, the Rush records he did, I'd heard, I really liked a lot.
Oh, yeah.
There's something else he did. Someone played me. I think Damon played me. I'm trying to think what record it was. So there was a couple things I heard, and I'd heard of him, and we had some mutual friends, and that's we kind of started from there. And then when we started talking to him, it became apparent he was going to fit into our personalities really well, and he had some ideas about how we should approach this thing. So it just, you know, it's kind of like you get a read on somebody and where they are creatively, and, you know, kind of where they're at,
yeah,
what they're trying to achieve, and how fast or slow that they work, and how they approach working, and, you know, there's a certain, it's all about, you know, you've got to realize you're going to spend like 4 to 6 weeks nonstop with this person, you know. So you want it to be someone you're in simpatico with, and you have the same goals.
Yeah, like a couple of things now, that the way the business is now. One, a lot of the musicians, they don't actually do the albums in the same studio. And two, they often self-produce it, that they don't actually get an outside producer in. But you've gone the other route completely, where, from what I can gather, Jimmy, none of you wanted to self-produce it, and you all had to be in the same room to record the album together.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's exactly it. So I think we could have actually done the record by ourselves, produced it by ourselves, but I don't think it would be as good, because I think sometimes you just need that guy to say, you know, to veto certain things and to throw certain things in the mix you wouldn't think of.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you're paying for. I don't want to play this guy the demos. We go play the demos for Dope for Note. He goes, oh, those are great. Because then at that point, you're just an engineer. You're just recording.
Yeah.
I mean, I want someone to take our ideas and enhance them or give us some new food for thought or do something. And that's what a good producer does. And stay off your phone.
Yeah. Is there any song in particular on the album that, like, Nick tweaked? Not a lot, but more than others. Can you think of any?
You know what? I can't say one more than the other. I mean, he had his hand in everything.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't rewrite anything, but we came in with the basic structure, and, like, he would turn this, he would go, no, the chorus is the verse of the chorus, and we're like, yeah, I don't think so. And then it would work. And we're like, oh, never mind, you're right. And, you know, there's certain things, but you know what? None of us could figure that out on this song or that song, and just little things like that, or like, bring the tempo down, bring the tempo up, let's change the key, let's try this, let's change your lyric. It's just those little things that you need that outside person that hasn't been listening, hasn't gotten attached to these ideas to come in and change them around a bit, and that's what he does.
Does Robbie change the band dynamic a lot? Like, what did he bring to the table for this record?
You know, Robbie's, you know, a great personality and a great bass player. He's just that all-around positive guy, and I don't think he's change the dynamic. I mean, I won't say, you know, I'm glad Marco's gone and Robbie's in. I mean, Marco was great. He's a great guy. He's a great bass player. He just wants to do other things. And it's as simple as that. And Robbie's just a different personality. He's a little bit out there, but, you know, he's always fun to have around. He's really energetic, and he's just Robbie. I mean, there's a reason he's been around us, you know, and played with a bunch of people. He's a great bass player, and he's great to have around, you know. And we were lucky to get him.
Yeah. It definitely, it's for, you know, something like what you guys are doing. I mean, that's one of those things people are going to, you know, at least for the first few albums, are going to always have that critical eye of like, oh, what's the bass player sound like? Because Phil played bass and all that.
Well, you know, the thing as far as bass player, I think Robbie, I don't know intentional or not. I mean, Robbie's tone on this album, I thought, came out really fat, like a lot fatter than the first record, and I was kind of looking for that. I was looking for like a sort of a kind of really fat, grizzly sort of like bass tone. And I thought, you know, it was maybe a little bit too clean on the first record, so it's a little bit fatter on this record. I thought that's one thing he brought to the table, because he's got a slightly different style and sound than Marco. And not good or bad. It's just a little bit, I think he's more into like a dirtier rock sound. And I think it actually fattened out a lot of our low-end stuff. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys being in the rhythm section, too, a lot of times, you know, that's a big part of the dynamic, right? That as a drummer, if you get that tone out of the bass, it suddenly you're grooving into that. It just glues you guys together that much better if you're both appreciating just the overall tone and sound the other guy's bringing.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, it certainly works it together. And I like to hear a really fat bass sound. I've never been a fan of, like, really clean muso sort of bass sounds. I want a dirty, like almost a punk rock sound. I want like a real dirty, you know, P bass to an SBT.
Yeah, you want a big solid ass P bass sound, and I think that does it just makes you dig in a different way, and just kind of inspires you to do something a little different than what you normally would do if someone was playing, like, you know, a jazz bass or, you know, something like that, or an alembic or something. That P bass with something solid, like you said, like with an SVT, just it kind of makes you do something different musically.
Yeah, you're right. And that's, I just like that whole, you know, that vintage instrument, and I like that sound. So, you know, as far as that, I think he brought a little bit of that to the table. But, you know, just his personality, just have him around. He's always good for a few laughs. And, you know, he's just a great guy.
Yeah, so Jimmy, talking about the live set, I know you got a tour coming up soon in Europe with Europe.
Yeah.
So the last time we talked to you, you said that you're always constantly on to Scott about playing these old Lizzy songs. So how's that going for you these days?
This is Emerald! Bad, never lived to be ready. All the money, all the love.
You know what? We haven't even touched on it anymore since I talked to you, because honestly, I'm leaving Sunday. I have to go over to England to start doing pre-production. So I'll probably be getting into that. That exact topic about a week from now.
Okay.
So nothing has changed. So no arguments have taken place yet. So, you know, I think, you know, we're going to all be together, I think, in 5 or 6 days, and we have to start sitting down and really figuring out the set list and what we're going to play new, what we're going to play from the first record, what we're going to play from the Lizzy catalog. So, it's going to be a hard one.
Yeah, I think it will be tough, Jimmy, because do you drop stuff from the first record to keep the same amount of Lizzy songs in? How many of the new songs you're going to put in? You know, it's going to be tough.
These are exactly the talks that are going to take place. I mean, honestly, these are things we've already sort of had really brief conversations with, but we really have to figure this out because, you know, we're going to have to play, you know, we're going to play, I don't know, do we do a third? I don't know. I can't answer it. I mean, I've already been thinking about it. So I'm like, well, if we have a 15-song set, do we do 5 Lizzy songs, 5 from the new first record, 5 from the second record, or do we do, you know, 7 Lizzy songs and then 7 BSR songs for the first 2 records? So, I mean, I don't know how to approach this yet.
Yeah. And are you headlining that tour, or is it a co-headline?
It's a co-headline tour.
Okay, nice.
So I think they're going to close. I'm not sure. I'd rather they close, honestly.
Okay.
So, but I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'll have to ask about that.
Yeah, how familiar are you with them, with their music now, the York music?
You know what? Not really. I've heard a couple songs. I met them in passing over the years. They seem to be really nice guys.
Yeah, I think you're the same manager.
Adam just started managing them about, I think, a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So when he brought up the idea, because we keep running to them at festivals in Europe. You know, we did a couple of things in Germany with them, and then we saw them at, you know, Sweden Rock, and then we see them someplace else. And I saw them when I was doing some gigs with Alice Cooper. And so I've seen them around for years. Like I said, every time I see them, they seem to be really pleasant guys. So we're like, you know, they're like, you guys want to do a tour together? We're like, yeah, sure. You know?
Yeah, I think their sound has definitely gone back into a 70s feel. So I think, your audience is going to go, you're going to go really well with their audience and vice versa.
Oh, good. Awesome. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I wasn't really sure where they were musically. I was more interested, like, hey, if we're going to be spending a couple weeks with them, are they going to be cool to hang? Are they going to be, you know, there's going to be a bunch of drama or whatever. And I think it'll be a real easy hang.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, I think more about. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I think it's cool, too, that even though I'm wishing you were touring, like, around here first, but I think ideally for you guys, it's probably better to tour this first over in Europe as well, because I think that's going to really let you see what goes over well live and stuff without having a bunch of people that are just standing in there with their arms crossed waiting for the next Thin Lizzy song. I think that there's a lot more acceptance of newer and different kind of mixed up stuff over in Europe. I think it'd be a good barometer for things.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is, too, I got to tell you, and you're probably already aware of it, you know, the UK and Europe in general are just more receptive to new music.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just what it is. I mean, the States, it's a really hard nut to crack or to actually generate any interest, or it just people, there's just a general sense of apathy here towards new music and bands. And, you know, there's going to be the same old, you know, touring packages this summer. I'm already starting to see them. Let me see, the last 3 package tours from last summer, they've just thrown the cards up in the air and then they've restructured them. It's okay.
Yeah.
Looking at this. Like, oh, wow, that's a shocker, you know.
And they're twice more expensive.
I'm sorry, and they're what?
They're twice more expensive.
Yeah, right, and let's jack the price up. You know, and it's like, I'm like, wow, that was real creative of, you know, the booking agencies. Like, wow, and the promoters, let's just switch this band B that we had out last year on this tribute package with band C. It's like, you know.
Yeah,
but it is what it is. You know, I mean, at least people are coming out to see something. It's too bad that people aren't, you know, I don't know if they're not looking for anything a little bit newer, or it's just that, like I said, that general sense of apathy where it's just people are too, you know, they don't have time to go hunt new music down, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I know Europe have announced, they've announced some dates in the U.S. I was hoping you guys would be on the bill with them, but I don't think you are. So,
I think we are doing something with them.
Oh, nice.
Newsflash. We are doing a few dates with them because I just was, this was a call we were talking about yesterday, and I think we're going to do a few. I don't think we're doing all of them.
Okay.
I think we're going to try to do a few of them, though, and I think they're in April, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. You said it, and it became true.
Yeah, and they're probably not playing off our way.
Well, you know, no, well, I don't know. I honestly, I didn't hear anything. Well, there might be a show in the Northeast.
Yeah, New York, I think, would probably be the nearest.
Yeah, that would probably be the nearest. But you know what? I also remember I was told not to say anything, so, oh, well, whatever.
Okay.
You know, no, I swear to God, like, oh, but don't tell anybody. I'm like, well, wouldn't that be the point, to tell people?
Yeah, you're trying to promote something, but I can't tell
anybody. Yeah. Hey, okay, we're going to do these gigs. Don't tell anybody. Well,
Why didn't anybody turn up? Because you told me not to tell anyone.
Yeah, exactly. Why isn't anyone at the gigs? Well, you said not to tell anyone. Okay, you know, it's like, so yeah, so I think we're going to do a few shows down the States, not a lot, but a handful. So I'll actually know more about that in the next week to 10 days, I'm hoping.
Yeah. Jimmy, I want to ask you a question, just a question about bass players. Now, I don't play at all, right? Now, you've played with a lot of different players over the years, be it Robert Trujillo, Phil Kenamore, you played with David Ellefson and all these guys. They've all had different styles. Was there any player in particular that you had difficulty in the beginning locking in with him to play?
Wow, good question.
Think
of this all day or what?
Wow.
No,
I don't play anything.
He looks around the studio here and he just goes like, bloody hell, what is all this crap that you keep getting? Like, how many guitars do you need? How many amps do you need? And just like, he could give a rat's ass about any of it. So yeah, he's definitely just a pure ass music fan.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I have to answer that with no, because all the guys you mentioned, all the bass players I played with were really unique in their own respect. I'm trying to think. I mean, I played with a few, like those guys in particular. I mean, like Bob Daisley was great, Ellefson was great, Trujillo was great, Kenamore was a different guy. Kenamore was almost like a punk rock guy at times, you know, but he had his own vibe. He was cool. Then all, you know, then the different guys like, you know, Todd Jensen and Greg Smith. I mean, all those guys, really, really good bass players. And, you know, of course, Robbie and Marco. No, I mean, there's been certain guys like I've been in bands, I won't say it was, but we've auditioned guys. Like to join the band, and some pretty big bands. We tried people, and I could tell you after like 10 seconds, I'm like, yeah, no, you know, or playing with somebody where they just don't, their playing doesn't fit in, or it doesn't feel right, or something like that. But all those bass players you mentioned, those are all really, really unique personalities and musicians. I mean, I'm really, like I said, I mentioned a lot of stuff. I'm really lucky. I've got to play with a lot of great. A lot of great musicians. I mean, I was driving back from snowboarding the other day, and I don't know if I had XM on or what radio it was. It might have been in my phone. Some old Suicidal Tendencies track came up, and I was like, God, what a crushing band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but yeah. I haven't listened to any of that in like 20 years. I'm like, man, it was a rad band. But you know, like a lot of the bands I've been in, like I said, I've been really fortunate. There's been some really great players.
Yeah.
Which band did you play with Bob Daisley and Jimmy Dorn?
Oh, I was in, yeah, no, I remember. I'm not Scott. I was playing sessions for the Ultimate Sin record for Ozzy.
Oh, it was back then. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think we talked about that last time.
You told me. I forgot. I'm Scott.
No, you forgot. Hey guys, you asked me the same question you did 4 months ago.
Yeah,
man.
I know.
Going downhill fast. One thing I think it's been pretty nice to see about this album, and it must be refreshing for you guys too, is after all of the crap that went around, the drama about whether you guys were BSR or Thin Lizzy, and all the focus on, you know, the name change and all this crap, that it's nice to see that a lot of the press, the interviews, the focus on all this time is really on Black Star Rioters as a band. And it seems like all that other stuff has, for the most part, gone away. And for me, I thought that's really great to finally see that.
play. We kind of figured that would have to happen at some point. It's not called Thin Lizzy, and it's like I said, there's the connection. I mean, I like talking about it. I really don't have any personal attachment to it because I didn't play in Thin Lizzy. I'm just a big fan, so I like hearing when I'll be sitting with Scott. He's doing press about it. And he talks about it. It's fun for me to listen to, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it's better now. People are realizing that the band's its own creative entity, and they're more directed towards that as opposed to like they play old Thin Lizzy songs.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Which I still want to do. I can't emphasize that enough. That's never going to go away. So I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. I think it is cool too. I think it's moving in a different direction. So which is nice to see.
It's gonna be great, especially for Scott to finally. Be like out from under that. So yeah, that is definitely cool. So is there any one particular track on the new one that you're really going to push once you get over there for pre-production and say, guys, this, we've got to get this one done live?
No, it's the same argument. I mean, it's the same argument again, where it's like, we've already talked about the set and we're all sort of on a different page. Mm. So, I mean, I'm okay playing anything from the new record. We're just going to have to, I think we're going to have to experiment with a few things over the first couple shows and see what goes over live.
Sure.
And also we want to see what's, you know, getting radio exposure in Europe. I mean, right now, Killer Instinct's doing really well on the radio over there. So I mean, we're obviously going to do that. Jump in about three more, I think, to start, and then figure out what the cover from the first record. So yeah, it's gonna, like I said, next week's gonna be real telling about what we're gonna do.
Yeah, and yeah. There's the balance too, right? Because it really does depend on what else you play to get a set that flows the right way. You just can't pick, you know, seven of this and seven of that and expect it to all flow together. There's got to be, you know, this ebb and flow and, like, you know, breaks for voices and things like that.
Right. So. And here again, you're right, because, you know, if you just pick all your favorite songs and put them together, that may not be a good set list.
Right.
So you're right. You have to have transition songs. You've got to bring it down once or bring it down twice and build it up again. And you have, you know, you're open and you have sort of getting to the set meet and a couple transition songs. So, yeah, it's almost like you're kind of making a roadmap.
Yeah.
And you just can't throw in a bunch of New Yorks and make it a roadmap. You know what I mean? It's got to be like, yeah, a little Iowa and a little bit of Luda Florida in there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think, Jimmy, I think I'll throw my two cents in. I think you have to play Bullet Blues.
Yeah, that's another one. See, I would say Little Liar, Bullet Blues, Killer Instinct, and Soldier Town. Those would be the first four I drop in the set.
Yeah, well, Soldier Town, I think first date's either in Dublin or Belfast, so throw that one in for definite.
Yeah, well, there, you know what? I forgot. You're right. I think it's Belfast, Dublin, and I think Edinburgh, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Yeah, so you got to figure, yeah, I would think you got to do that one there. So, but those would be my first four to drop in, but like I said, I don't know.
Yeah, it is tough because there are so many good songs on this.
Well, you know, at least we're not saying, hey, man, we only really have one or two good songs to play out this record, so.
That's true. Yeah, thank goodness for that. Another cool thing I like, too, on this is you guys kept that, World War II nose art theme going on this album, too. I thought that was just really cool that you did that.
Yeah. We can always find good war stuff to put on an album cover. I wanted to do a tank, but apparently we're sticking to the airplane again.
You know, that's one thing I always loved about bands, that when they have these identifiable themes, you just kind of look and you're like, oh, that's got to be that band. It's just the just kind of recognition on the cover. And I just thought that's cool to maybe try to identify that with you guys and stuff. It is a kick-ass cover, too.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know, the fact that it goes, too, like the killer instinct, and that it's portrayed as nose art, too. And you'd almost think, my God, did they actually find a plane that had that on that? Because it just, you know what I mean? It's like it belongs. Yeah.
Listen, it's hard to do this stuff. You'd be amazed how many hours we spend talking and emailing and texting art ideas and talking to the art people and them coming up with ideas and us shooting them down and correcting them. And then there's, it's funny that when you come up with a title for a record, that everyone wants to sort of like, oh, I don't know, can you call a record Killer Instinct? And we're like, why not?
Right.
And then people come back, well, it's violent, it's Killer Instinct, and it's heading towards violence. It's like,
Walmart won't carry it.
I didn't even think of that.
Jimmy, you should have said you're on the Suicidal Tendencies album with fucking the first four songs.
Hey, you know what? Check it out. Walmart wouldn't carry that.
Yeah. Nope. I do remember you telling me that.
Yeah, Walmart wouldn't carry that. And you know what? I don't even think, check this out, that record's not even on iTunes.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
You can't even buy it. Yeah. Like, so there's even more money I'm not getting paid.
Yeah.
But, I'm sorry, what were you talking about?
The cover art.
Cover art.
Now you're being Scott.
No, I forgot. What band am I talking about? Never mind. No, I mean, I thought it was fine, and then someone came back and was, we know there's a lot of violence in the world, and there's this and that, and I said, I know there's always violence, though. I mean, it's not promoting violence or killing, it's not promoting anyone, act in a violent way or anything. I said, as a disclaimer, why don't we call it Killer Instinct and put a picture of a couple of puppies on it at the cover,
And with Michael Vick.
Yeah. That's bad. See, I wouldn't go there, man.
But it is. I mean, you talk about how much time you guys spent back and forth on that. And what's so cool about that is you look at that cover and you think, wow, just like, it seems like such a simple concept. The amount of time it takes to make something look that simple and easy is,
it's a lot of hours. And it's like, we get the first draft, it comes back, it's like, yeah, the bomb's too small. All right, that goes back again. Mm. We get the next draft. No, the bomb's too big, the girl's too small. Okay, it goes back again. No, I don't like the font. The amount of time. No, I don't like the color of green in the background. Oh, the sky is too cloudy. It's just endless.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. Like, I'll tell you, so years ago, there's a YNC record called Musically Incorrect, right?
Mm-hmm. The two kids on the cover.
With the two kids standing in front of the Ford Torino?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We couldn't come up with an album thing. We just couldn't come up with anything, okay? So me and Phil Kenmore went up to this place called, I probably shouldn't even tell you this, before there was internet, this was like, the late 90s, mid-90s. We went up to this place in San Francisco. It was a photo archive place, right? And I was going through thousands of random photos. And I came across that photo with the two kids that looked like they were just in the car. They just got out of a car that was, you know what I mean? There was two kids with this shocked expression on their face.
Yep.
And It was in front of a Ford Torino, and I'm like, Phil, this is so not connected to anything we've ever done. We have to use it. And he's like, yep. And we literally licensed the photo for like $75, okay? That was our album, okay? So the other photo I was looking at was this shot of this man being shot in the stomach at point-blank range with a cannonball.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's a classic photo, yeah.
You're right. And I'm like, well, we could buy this one for $75 or however much it was to archive it. Well, that was it wound up being the next Van Halen cover.
That's right. Van Halen 3.
And I'm like, yeah, the one with Gary Cherone. I remember when it came out, I'm like, dude, that's the photo we were looking at in the archive place, you know?
Oh, man.
That was a lot easier to do than these, but, you know, a lot of work goes into this stuff sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure Phil got a big kick out of that, too. Like, yeah, we're going to make something that's absolutely not connected to anything, and we'll just laugh because they'll think they're missing some kind of inside joke. There'll be some deep insight. It seems to me
that
it would fit right with Phil's sense of humor.
Yeah, I just like, he's like, oh, I like the expression on the kids. I'm like, I think the car is cool. They're like, yeah, let's use that. But we're both, I'm like, should we use this cannonball one? He's like, yeah. He's like, that might be a little bit too out there. I'm like, all right, cool. Next year, it's on a Van Halen cover. We're like, never mind.
Yeah, Jimmy, I got one Y&T question for you, and I never got to it the last time when we talked to you.
Yeah,
The two anthologies that came out, were you happy that they came out? Because sometimes bands don't want some of the rejected songs or their demos to actually come out.
What was on that? I can't remember.
It was all the demos for all the albums. Some of them were like unreleased tracks. Some of them were on soundtracks.
Yeah. Oh, that was the Unearthed One and Two.
Yes,
thing?
Correct.
Okay. No, I was cool with that actually because there was a lot of stuff that was good. There was a lot of stuff that wasn't so good.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I didn't care. I figured, you know what? There's never going to be any more Y&T music from that era.
Yeah.
You know, I mean. That's all there is. That's all that exists.
The one thing it said to me when I listened to it was, you guys wrote a lot of songs.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that Geffen passed on, and there's a lot of stuff that we passed on, and we demoed everything, and I thought it was cool that it came out. As a matter of fact, a few things Dave was missing, I had. He's like, hey, do you remember this? I'm like, I think I still have the work cassette, and I gave it to him. So it was a thing where I was cool getting it out because I thought people would want to hear it, you know, and you know, they liked it, cool, they didn't like it, cool, whatever. Just the fact that that's the bottom of, there's nothing more. That's all there is.
Yeah, well, this was a 270-odd-minute CD, so that's a pretty lot. That's a lot of music that's been unreleased.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to him about a month ago because they were talking about re-releasing something, and somebody wanted to know if we had any bonus archive songs from, like, the early 90s, and we were both scratching our heads. I'm like, I think we put everything out that we have.
Wow.
Unless I've got a big box of war cassettes I might dig through, but I honestly think I don't think there's a thing left.
There's not a lot of bands do that.
I mean, like I said, we dug through everything we had 10 years ago when we put those out, and I just don't think there's anything left, but it'd be interesting to see. I mean, we have, man, I don't know. I just think that's the bottom of it. I mean, there's just nothing left. We put everything out that we could, and if we come across, and it's kind of like, you know, the way Hendrix catalog and Led Zeppelin catalogs, things kind of emerge still after 40 years. I just don't think, I just think we put everything out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Hey, but guys, hey, listen, I'm going to have to jump here.
Yeah, no problem, Jimmy.
No, I have a family thing I have to do, but listen, if you have like one last question we want to do or anything to wrap it up, that'll help you guys. I'm good with that.
We're good, Jimmy. It's always great to have you on. Definitely one of our favorite guests, and we always have a great time talking with you. So.
Well, I like when you guys come up with like good questions and stuff because, I mean, like when we talked last time, I was, you know, I don't do a lot of these things, but so what was it like? You know, I get the same stuff a lot of times. So what was it like to work with Nick? What's it like to play with Scott? How do you think the first record covers are the first record? And you guys, like, kind of blow by all that stuff.
Yeah, we don't do the what's it like question because you're just going to get the standard answer back. Oh, it's great. Oh, it's great. Oh,
yeah,
it's great.
The quick synopsis you gave us at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, we don't do
that. I'm going to do the, what's it, the running back for the Seattle Seahawks when you did that one interview a couple weeks ago, the one that doesn't like to do press, I forget.
And Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah, Marshawn Lynch, yeah. Too. Fine. Thank you for asking.
Yeah. I'm doing this media interview because I have to do it, not because I want to do it.
I was watching that. I'm like, that's a really weird way to do an interview, but I guess he's not promoting a record. So
There you go. Hopefully, Jimmy, if you get over this side of the States, I'll get to shake your hand and say hello.
Well, hopefully I will, and it'll be warmer than 18, man, you know?
We hope so.
I'm like, that's like, I came back there last week, and I'm like, okay, this is exactly why I moved away.
All right, Jimmy, we'll leave you go.
No, hey, I'm kidding, guys. I love it back there. It's just cold for me sometimes. But listen, you guys, thanks for all the stuff you do for us. We do appreciate it, and enjoy your weekend, and, you know, just give me a shout. You have my number.
Yep, I do. So. All right, Jimmy.
All right, guys.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Jimmy.
All right, man, see you.
Bye. All right, that is a wrap for this week. Big thanks to Jimmy DeGrasso for coming on. We had a blast, and, of course, also big thanks to Richie for setting that one up. And if you haven't already done so, get in there, place your pre-order for Black Star Riders brand new one, The Killer Instinct. Like I said at the beginning of the show, not a lot of music on this one. Explained why. Did play a few things. Played The Rage from Priest. That was a great show back there. I think I went to the July 7th, 2009 show. Killer show. That, of course, was The Rage live on the British Steel Anniversary Tour. Played a track from The Almighty, Free and Easy. That one was from the Download Festival in 92. Played that one just for Richie. And, of course, they also played Black Star Riders doing their version of the great Thin Lizzy song Emerald. And the last thing, of course, that we played was the title track off of The Killer Instinct, titled, amazingly, The Killer Instinct. So like I said, that is a wrap for this week. Hope you enjoyed it, and hope you enjoyed all the shows we've been putting out lately. I know we'll have something great coming up next week. Lots of different choices of what to pick. Haven't really nailed it down yet, or if I have, then Richie's going to hear this and remind me what it was we agreed on. I have to confess, ever since the NAMM show and the reports coming out of that, my head has been in gear land. Lots of cool stuff that debuted at that show, and I don't know, I probably want about 80% of it. As always, keep up with us at focusonmetal.net, focusonmetal.blogspot.com, on Twitter. And if you are so inclined, you could shoot Richie or I an email, richie@focusonmetal.net, scott@focusonmetal.net. So for myself and Richie and everybody else here at Focus on Metal, we really appreciate the support, continued listenership, the growing listenership that we have out there. It's great to see this show growing. And as always, have yourselves a great metal week. And until we talk to you again, remember,
focus on metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.